This is The Think Tank, talking about the major political, economic, and social issues of the week. With Dr. Mike O'Neill and hosted by Mike Russell. KTAR News on 92.3 FM and KTAR.com. The Think Tank.
Okay, our recurrent topic, given our political environment, is immigration. Hopefully, we can spew some facts into the venom and discourse that is our current politics. We have two people with us here today. Evelyn Cruz teaches immigration law and comprehensive law practice and directs the college's, ASU's that is, Immigration and Law Policy Clinic, which represents unaccompanied minors on immigration removal proceedings, and our own Martha Maurer, who has her own immigration story, as Evelyn does as well. And we're going to start with you, Martha. And you have a story to tell. By the way, congratulations. Cast your first vote, I understand, the other day.
Yes, I did.
How long was the line?
For me, it was only half an hour, thankfully, because I was there at 6 a.m. So I did not have to wait the hours and hours that others did. But I did cast my first ballot for president this last presidential preference election.
Oh, something you got to do. I didn't.
As a U.S. citizen for the first time, I felt like I really had to do it.
Yeah, but of course, I mean, as an independent, I don't get to vote. So.
Well, you know, funny you said that because I consider myself an independent too, but I decided that I wanted to participate being my first election, so I did go ahead and change my party affiliation just for this election.
Yep. There's a lot of independents who feel that that's a violation of their independence, but we're getting sidetracked. You have an immigration story to
I
tell.
Do.
It's about you and your whole family, so tell us.
Yeah, I came to the United States when I was 9 years old. I was born in Mazatlan, Mexico. And at 9 years old, I came with my entire family. We flew in right through Sky Harbor on a tourist visa. We had actually been here a few times before, and our father, my dad, was already here. So we came essentially to reunite with him. And
of course, coming here is on a tourist visa, my understanding. That's a perfectly legal beginning.
Right. And actually, as a child, and with my sister as well, we would come often. We visited the United States very often, probably once a year. Mm-hmm. At some point in our childhood, our dad decided to stay here. You know, I'm told that it was for economic reasons, wanted to provide better means for our family back in Mexico. But it was just too much to be separated. So when we finally decided to stay here, we essentially overstayed our visa. And that's how we ended up staying in the United States. At some point, though, that visa does expire, and then what happens is you're left with an illegal status.
So your status became illegal when the visa expired. And, of course, I think the interesting policy point is a wall would have done nothing to prevent
that. Right. I mean, I didn't. I flew into Sky Harbor, so
you can't build a wall that high.
Yeah. Right, yeah. Right. So.
Well, and not a selective one anyway.
Well, it's true.
And at least in my case, you know, I was only a kid, so it was the decisions of my parents who led me to, as an adult now, realize I didn't have a choice.
And Evelyn can correct me if I'm wrong on this, but it is my understanding that in terms of illegal immigration, that constitutes about 40% of it, overstaying visas.
That's correct. By most estimates, individuals come either through the border patrol, I mean, crossing through the border, or through the airlines. And so if you have a valid entry document that indicates that you're coming here to visit or on a short business, you can come over. And also, we have a number of countries that they don't even need an interview prior to obtaining that visa to enter into the United States.
And of course, I know down in the southern part of the state, there's whole communities, Nogales and others like them, that it is a huge part of their economic life. People come over not to be tourists, but to buy stuff.
Yeah, to shop, right?
Right. We have border crossing cards issued to individuals who live along the border that allows them to come to the United States for a variety of reasons, including shopping, including going to businesses within the United States that they may not be able to have, going to doctors in the United States. So it's a large industry. I was just in Nogales about a week and a half ago, and the line took me as long as it took for people to vote last week to get back into the United States.
We were all agreed that's too long. But it's also my understanding those kinds of entry visas are very geographically restricted. For example, you can go to Nogales. I don't know if you can go to Ajo. You certainly can't go to Phoenix.
Right. You would need an additional permission, and which they can issue you at the border.
Mm-hmm.
Now, how does that work? A lot of people don't know that, I would think. So how the heck does that work? How do you come across the border in the southern part of our state and then you just want to go to Phoenix, or they just say, you can't go to Phoenix? Do they check on the way up? How does that work?
Well, the Border Patrol patrols within 100 miles, and therefore there's a secondary checkpoint along the highways where they identify individuals who are not able to.
I can verify that. I drive 85 all the time, and there is secondary checkpoint is just south of Gila Bend.
Oh, yes, and that's right. I've been there.
So that's not only does it provide a check for people whose original crossing was perfectly legal, but if somebody hopped the fence, which is generally the easy part of the trip, the hard part is the next 100 miles through the desert. Mm-hmm. You basically, there's only one road up.
Correct.
And they patrol that road. So.
Now, Martha, now that you're here, you came here with your family, you obviously got to go to school, you go to Arizona State University, you get a job, you get married to a U.S. citizen.
We're getting ahead of ourselves.
I want to know that process. We always say our immigration system's broken. It's broken. Is it broken or is it just a really big pain in the butt?
I would say definitely both. And from my experience, and of course, I always have to say it's different for every single person. The immigration process is not the same across, every single case. But I feel blessed that I was able to go to school, go to public school here in Phoenix, and be able to go to Arizona State University. Now, I graduated in 2007. Right.
That's just before they switched. You paid in-state tuition.
I paid in-state tuition on a scholarship basis. My GPA allowed me to go to school for free. But there was a point in 2006 when a new law was passed where that became a problem for universities to be able to allow students to go to school, those who did not have documentation. So I kind of had to speed up my graduation. I graduated in 3 years instead of four because I didn't have a way to pay for it. But then after that, I was sort of left without a way of continuing. What do I do? How do I work? I had no legal means to do so. So it became challenging. Of course, I had to learn English throughout that time. And I think that plus my willingness not to just give up, I would find ways to work. I became a certified personal trainer, so I was able to teach people how to exercise correctly. I did internships with broadcasters. But it just didn't feel like I really had a complete future of being able to find a solid job. Come 2008, and I met, the love of my life, and we decided to initiate our immigration process via the fiancé visa. So we didn't just get married to be able to do this. We took it a step further, and we essentially petitioned the government to allow us to apply for fiancé visa status.
I'm going to hit pause on the story right there. Can you stay with us to the break?
Of course.
I greatly appreciate that. We have Evelyn Cruz here. She teaches immigration law and comprehensive law practices. And we have our very own Martha Mauer here telling her story. It's all things immigration in the Think Tank. Next.
The Think Tank. KTAR News on 92.3 FM and KTAR.com.
We are back.
And you were making fun of me, huh, about fidgeting before the show. I told you at least to have my buttons right.
I forgot to push the
there
on
you
button.
Go. See?
It's so complicated. I'm not the technical guy here, as we've established.
Yes.
We are here with KTR's own Martha Mauer and Professor Evelyn Cruz, and we're walking through your story. And just so people understand the issue of tuition, for example, prior to, I think it was 07, you said, as a resident of Arizona, you got in-state tuition. The legislature passed a law which prohibited, which basically charged out-of-state tuition. It probably cut off traditional scholarships as well, didn't it?
It absolutely did, and that was the challenge for me. So I had to figure out how do I get through school without, breaking my budget. And since I wasn't legally able to work, I didn't have a way to create an income.
And let me clarify. Use the word, if you used it correctly, scholarship is different from financial aid. You get a scholarship based on GPA and your performance. And I know this because I've had kids who've had them. Mm-hmm. And that's independent of financial need. And it actually can be quite generous depending on which tier you get into. But that was cut off as well.
And yes, and financial aid, let me be clear, was never available to me because of my immigration status. So I was never even able to get money from the government. Okay. It was all scholarship based on merit.
Okay.
So graduating from the top of my class, I was able to go and get free tuition, some other waivers for housing, for food, and to continue my education. But when that law passed, that went away. So I graduated early. Actually continued with a little bit of grad school with the help of some very helpful and amazing private donors. But that was the only way.
And
that
on that score, I know that Michael Crow's reaction to that was to go out and try to hustle a lot of private money to try to make up for.
And he absolutely did. And I'm thankful that I was able to go that far. So that's how I was able to go through school.
So you've graduated from college. You have found the love of your life. And you're in Phoenix, and what happens next?
Well, at that point, something had happened in my life to where, you know, I really had, I felt like there was no future, you know, couldn't work, couldn't do anything. I ended up leaving to go back to Mexico. Once I did that, it actually triggered a 10-year ban from me to return to the U.S. And that's because as a child, I had lived here illegally. And once you live here for a certain amount of time and you leave the country, then you trigger a 10-year ban, at least for Mexican nationals. And it may be different for other people.
It's for everyone.
It's for everyone.
Yeah,
okay.
I was going to point out for the record on radio here, everyone is nodding her head yes.
So in my case, it triggered that ban. So that's one little hurdle that I'll explain in a little bit. But my fiance at the time and I decided, okay, well, let's start. You know, we don't want to just jump into a marriage and get into this legal mess. Let's, you know, take it one step at a time. So we applied for a fiance visa. Essentially, we asked for permission for me to return to the U.S. and to start my legal process through my fiance with the acceptance that I will be marrying him, that I will not become a burden to society, that he had enough resources to support me once I got back, and that I was going to continue to be a very helpful member of society.
Did they do much in that interview? I know this has been an issue sometimes, to probe the legitimacy of, is this a real contemplated marriage? Did they ask a lot of personal questions to establish a relationship?
Well, the application itself, and we went through this in April of 2009, and so it's changed since. Mm-hmm. But in 2009, the application required different types of proof of a relationship. So we submitted lots of pictures. We submitted pictures together of our trip together, of our conversations, text messages, IM messages, emails, profile, social media profiles. Back then it was MySpace was the big thing. So we provided a lot of those things. Let me just, you know, put a little context into it.
Wow, it's like a time machine.
Right. Our application was actually approved, but because I had that ban triggered, I couldn't just return to the U.S.
Okay.
So then there was another process to petition for a waiver to bypass that ban, essentially. Okay. It was during that time that I had to.
And this ban is a 10-year ban?
It's a 10-year ban,
That's colossal.
So the way that, at least in my case, we had to prove, the U.S. citizen petitioning for me, my fiancé, had to prove that by myself not returning to the U.S., it was creating an extreme hardship for him. They call him a hardship waiver. At least that's how it was explained to us. So as a U.S. citizen, he had to explain, you know, if she doesn't come back, if Martha doesn't come back, this is how my life will be affected. And so we did, and we fought hard.
Emotional hardship, or does it have to justify it economically?
I would say a little bit of both, and maybe our expert here can weigh in. In our case, emotional, I was told, was not enough. There has to be a legitimate reason. Now, my fiance comes from a very long military family. That was something that we felt that was very strong to point out that, you know, his family is all over the U.S. and it's not possible for them to visit in Mexico.
Okay.
So there were a lot of other personal factors on his life. My life did not matter at that point. It was all about the U.S. citizen.
I see.
So we fought hard and we went with it and we actually got rejected. In a way, we were pushed to a backlog. The government decided that my case was not strong enough to just accepted right away.
And this is 09, 2010.
This is 09 to, you know, all the way to beginning of 2011. And in that time, I actually had to travel to Ciudad Juarez, which is south of the El Paso, Texas, mm-hmm. to go to physical in-person interviews with immigration attorneys. So I had to go there. It was during those interviews, too, that I had to continue to petition my case, continue to show that it was a legitimate relationship. So there came more of those proofs that you were talking about. Mm-hmm. Until finally, in the beginning of spring of 2011, I went back to Ciudad Juarez and I was finally accepted to be able to return to the U.S. They granted my waiver.
Was there something that pushed them over the edge, or was it just your...
You know, I'd like to think that it was the discretion of the officer, and that has to do... I encountered that a lot in every single step of the way, because it didn't even end there. I met with several immigration officers, and everybody's different. And you hear the word discretion a lot, and in my case, I think that had to do with a lot of it. Maybe, you know, he heard my story, my struggles, the things that I had accomplished while I was in the U.S., and felt that I was a person that needed to come back. Because legally, there was no hardship for me. You know, I did not matter. I was a U.S.
citizen.
That did not
matter. It's the hardship on the U.S.
Exactly.
Evelyn, how typical is this? And let's specifically the issue of discretion. How much discretion is there in this process?
So when the process is being done outside of the United States, the Constitution does not apply. The State Department officers are still employees of the U.S. government, so they do have to have some level of acknowledgement to constitutional rights. However, they do have a lot of discretion. My perfect example is my grandmother. My dad was an only child, a U.S. citizen of the United States. I do well economically. If we wanted to immigrate my grandmother, we could have done it very easily. But because my dad was an only child, my grandmother could not get a visa to visit the United States when I graduated high school, when I graduated college, law school, got married, had my first child. Finally, my son. They allowed her to come to visit us when my son was born. And so
we have a heartbreak right here. We'll come back to that story more with Evelyn Cruz, and Martha Maurer next on the Think Tank.
The Think Tank, KTAR News on 92.3 FM and KTAR.com.
We are back discussing immigration. Evelyn Cruz, let's get your personal story into this, because it's not from Mexico, it's from Central America.
It's from Central America. And so, as I was saying, my grandmother had a very difficult time to come over to the United States just to visit. She did not want to move to the United States. Like mm-hmm. I said, it would have been easy for my dad to petition her. Mm-hmm. All the cards were lined up. But she just wanted to visit. And so it took forever. And it really was a question of what officer you got that particular week and how they evaluated their decision. And things have, and this was back up, you know, 15, 20 years ago. Nowadays, it's even more difficult, because oftentimes one of their big concerns is like, I don't want to be the person who allows the next terrorist into the United States.
It's kind of like being a parole officer. There's a downside to one to saying yes.
Exactly.
And no downside to saying no.
And so that is always in the back of their mind, mm-hmm. That there could be. Now, in her situation, I think that one of the things that drove them into agreeing is a sense of atonement. It's a sense that this is someone who had proven in the past that she was a contributor to society. Mm-hmm. And even though it is not statutorily required, remember, they're outside the United States. They don't have to completely follow it. And so they had a more open book and trying to make that mm-hmm. decision. The other thing, of course, is the fact that her husband was a military person. Mm-hmm. One of the things that they often say is that, hey, if you really want to be with your spouse, the citizen doesn't have a right to have this person in the United States. We're not infringing on your marriage. You can move to the country where uh-huh. your spouse is now residing. And that happens often. Mm-hmm. There's a lot of people in which they literally move to border towns, so one spouse can be on one side and the other one in the other side while they're doing this 10-year wait, mm-hmm. And assuming they are not able to get a waiver. And in this situation, well, he was in the military. And if anything, we should provide our military the opportunity to have their spouse.
A military member does not have the freedom to locate to a border town.
Correct.
Go where they
and
tell
there already serving our country. What's the least we can do for them?
And just to clarify, and you know, I guess I'm even more thankful because my now husband wasn't in the military himself, but his entire family. So it was network. And so I think that shows another reason why discretion, I think, was widely used in my case.
One thing that I want to ask you about, Evelyn, and it's my understanding that for some years now, what country you comes from, we've set up special cases. So somebody decides to emigrate from Cuba, and now we're talking about a country that's essentially peaceful, where you have free health care, where nobody's starving. There's not a lot of political – there's no political freedom, but – You're in in contrast to somebody from a Central American country that's in the middle of a war that's run by gangs, where mom is told your kid joins the gang or we'll kill your whole family. The Cuban seems to get a free pass right now.
Well, we've had that policy for a number of years. It's called the Cuban Adjustment Act. So the idea is that if a Cuban national presents themselves at the border or touches U.S. grounds, they are given permission to enter into the United States and given something called parole, which allows them to remain in the United States and not fear removal. A year after being granted parole, they can apply for a green card. And then 5 years after that green card, they can become citizens. That offer is not available to anyone else, not even Haitians, who had a very similar situation back in the 1990s. And it became this point of contention in that you had a boatload of Cubans and a boatload of Haitians in
Miami. The Cubans get in, the Haitians get
exactly.
turned back.
I spent some of my childhood in Miami. So I'm very familiar with the Marielito situation, which was the 1980s boat lifts from Cuba. And so we do have a very convoluted system within the Immigration Service as to how, who gets what. And it's not just the situation with the Cuban. We allocate 20,000 visas, immigrant visas, per country. It does not take into account.
I thought we'd eliminated national quotas. That's not true?
We eliminated regional divisions in that we used to have a percentage of our population of 1910 as the calculus.
Basically, which meant that white Europeans got in. And
right, because the majority of people before 1910
that was what the population looked like.
Exactly. In 1956 and 1965, between then, we created a exact number of visas per country.
The same.
20,000.
Big country, small country.
Big country. No. So until in 1968, it went to effect with Mexico. At that point, about 20,000 visas had been. About 40,000 visas had been issued per year for Mexico. So the day that this went into effect, you automatically had a 20,000 backlog. And that is one of the reasons why you see petitions for siblings being 16 years, 17 years. In contrast, I mentioned I immigrated when I was a child. I came through my mother's sister. And at that time, it took less than 3 years for the waiting line because it was El Salvador in the 1970s. There weren't as many people petitioning, and therefore the line wasn't as long.
Now, the line, I hear references to, quote, the line. Let's assume somebody has no family connections, whatever.
They're
coming here
no
from
line
Mexico.
For them.
Basically, it's forever.
Are there different lines?
So there are different lines. We have a family petition line, and there is immediate family and your siblings, and that's it. So you can only petition, if you're a citizen, you can petition your siblings and you can petition your parents. If you only have a green card, you can only petition your unmarried children and your spouse. So that's the one line. There's a second line for business, and that one is related mostly to skilled workers. We don't have, like other countries have, a way for less quote-unquote college-educated individuals to enter into the United States. I study other countries as well and their immigration systems. So, and then on top of that, we have certain specialty visas, if you will, the Cuban system, visas for individuals who have been trafficked, visas for individuals who have helped us with criminal investigations. So that's about a 10,000 visa.
Isn't then there also one for about $500,000 you can in effect buy a visa?
That's under the business.
Yeah.
You have to adapt and you have to employ a number of people.
Yeah.
It's an L visa. And then then investor visa, rather. And then we also have, of course, our refugee system, in which we admit up to 70,000, depending on the year, from abroad. And
total worldwide, 70,000?
Yeah, it's not that much. And then internally, we grant asylum to individuals. When we accept refugees, we go out and go into the refugee camps, and that's when we interview them and figure out. If a person wants to be a refugee, they can't just show up at the U.S. embassy.
Now, you said you study other countries' immigration
Correct.
Systems. What? Who's knocking the ball out of the park, and who's behind us?
So, interestingly enough, way behind us has been Germany.
Okay.
Germany did not create their immigration statute until 2000 and their citizenship statute until 2005. But they're catching up very quickly.
Well, aren't they, in terms of the Syrians, haven't they taken in way more Syrians than
right.
anybody?
Right. They promised to take 80,000. Now, part of the situation with them is that there is an agreement between all the countries in Europe in which you have to apply for refugee status in the first country you land in. And for many years, Germany just bought their way out of it. They just send money to places where that, you know, because they're landlocked.
They're sending some money to Turkey right now.
They deal
with Turkey.
Right. They send money to Turkey, Greece, and Italy, and Spain to deal with the refugee applicants there. And because they were landlocked. Now, one of the things that they are facing, however, is that they are losing population. Most of Europe is an aging population. And therefore, they're seeing this as an opportunity to see if they can pick from the litter, if you will, the better immigrants.
One thing I get to, and we talked about this in the break, and I asked you about the question, what is the current level of net migration from Mexico and from the rest of Central America? And you asked me to distinguish between illegal and legal. I'd like you to answer both questions, if you
right.
would.
So,
give us some idea of the...
Right. So statistically speaking, we still admit every year the 20,000 visas that I mentioned and the number of individuals who are under the outside of that, immediate relatives, as they call mm-hmm. them, parents, spouses, and minor children of U.S. citizens are not counted against that data. And so we're allowing about 1 million family petitions per year. I'm not sure about the business immigration end of it because I don't teach that area.
And not big numbers, I think.
Right.
You need $500,000
exactly.
to invest. That's not...
So we have a net...
But then you have people who are Mexicans going south.
Right. And so you have Mexicans going back. And you also have expats. You have a large population of Americans who are settling outside of the United States in their retirement years. Mm-hmm. It's a big population in a number of places in Mexico, and so there is that fluidity mm-hmm. to the border that goes back and forth. But the numbers relating to undocumented individuals living in the United States, the number coming in is a lot less than the number going out. So in there, we do not have a growing undocumented population.
That's staggering in terms of the debate. You're saying more
Correct.
People are leaving than coming in.
Right. And there's a number of reasons for that, including the fact that Mexico's economy has improved quite substantially in the last few years. I just came back from Puebla. They added like half the city in the last 10 years. They have built a number of infrastructure projects that are attracting people to settle back there.
Evelyn Cruz, thank you so much for being here. Martha Maurer, thank you for sharing your story. We appreciate that. And congratulations again on your first vote. We're very proud of you.
Thank you.
Very, very proud of you. Doc and I are going to tie a bow around the immigration debate next.
The Think Tank. KTAR News on 92.3 FM and KTAR.com.
So basically, Doc, the biggest takeaway, I'm getting, is that when we say immigration system, boy, that's a fluid system, isn't it?
I mean,
there's not one line going to one thing. There's not just, okay, here's how you do it. Here's A plus B equals C is not the way this happens. It is darn near case by case. It's head by head.
Well, this is why you have things called immigration lawyers
who can
navigate your way through that system. And it's clear we're making all sorts of special case. Everybody's a special case. What you heard there is if you're just a random Mexican and you want to come here legally, basically you can't.
Right.
You need a sibling, a parent, some connection, $500,000 to start a business and employ at least 10 people. You need to get into some special category, or else you're or in Martha's case, a fiancé.
Sure. So what we can say is this. When a lot of people say we have a broken immigration system, what I'm taking away is we just have a governmental immigration system. We have a very bureaucratic immigration system. But also she said what I thought was fascinating that Evelyn said that I didn't even think of. She's like, you know, a lot of these people are down in Mexico going through this process. Our Constitution does not matter down there. Yeah. That is that absolutely put things together for us.
This is the same reason we have a place called Guantanamo, because the Constitution does not apply and there are no legal rights.
But as far as immigration is concerned,
But it's the same point. Once you leave the borders of this country, it's a different set of rules.
Okay. Now, Martha, obviously someone we want here. There's countries that would recruit to have 100 Marthas show up tomorrow.
Educated, resourceful.
Hardworking, everything. Right, she's got it all. She's firing on all cylinders there. But one thing, and I will tell you, that I know our listener base very, very well. And a lot of our listener base heard free education, free government program, get you on your feet, this, that, and the other thing, when they're all sitting around trying to think about, hey, how do I pay for my kids' college? Mm-hmm. And they're here, right? So, and they're U.S. citizens. Well, that I think, is one of the rubs when we talk about immigration, even for someone like Martha, that we would all, if we knew her resume, raise our hand and say, yeah, bring her, please.
Yeah, a couple of points about that. One is she did not get a nickel of financial aid. She got a scholarship. They're two different things.
Okay. It's still free school.
Right.
Either way, it's free school.
And that scholarship is available to anybody who meets the academic requirements.
Okay.
So,
fine.
So,
right.
Yeah, yes,
my kids got straight A's, and I'm still looking at $200,000 for college. Well, so do you see what I mean? So I think that's one of the big rubs on the other side. But once again,
straight A's will get you a full scholarship at ASU.
You see what I'm saying, though. Yeah. But you see what I'm saying.
Oh, I see. Somebody's saying that and saying, yes, if this non-citizen gets that, then some citizen somewhere could have got that money.
Or just why the heck does my citizen have to pay for it and non-citizens don't?
The second point about that is over.
Okay, right.
That does not occur. That there was an 07 law, not a nickel.
Here was something that was fascinating was the 10-year ban. I don't think a lot of people know about this. And the reason why I bring
That's severe.
Part of my role here on this show is to bring up the common man's point, because we study a lot of politics. Mm-hmm. You study even more so in things like this. So you probably knew about the 10-year ban. I don't think a lot of people know that if you come up here into this country, stay a certain amount of time, the second you step that little piggy toe back over the border, banned. 10 years.
I will tell you, I didn't know how long. I knew it wasn't easy.
Yeah.
10 years kind of staggered me. I didn't realize it was that severe. I mean, 10 years is a big chunk of your life.
Yes.
And no certainty at the end of the 10 years. You know, it's not like you get the green card at the end of the 10 years. After 10 years, we will review your application.
Yes.
You're forbidden. Mm-hmm. You know, so that's huge. And I think that's probably something that's not well known. People think, oh, getting the end of the line, you know, you wait 6 months and then you're back in. Well, as we've heard, unless you fit into some nice category, sibling, some other reason like that, there is no line. Essentially, there is no line. There's no way in.
And how about that, too? Martha was talking about how she had to go to just south of El Paso. I forget the name of the
Ciudad
town.
Juarez, by the way, which you may recognize as essentially a war zone.
Yeah, we don't want to go there. But here's the deal. You know, we think about we don't think about that. If you're on a 10-year ban, she was applying for a waiver because she had a fiancé up here. And they were doing it the right way. God bless them. Yep. They didn't just go to the Little White Chapel in Vegas and try to make that happen. They were doing things the right way. She had to travel to her law office, her immigration attorney, and back, and then back, and then back. They're not everywhere like we just roll up to QT on the corner here,
and
right?
You'll notice, A, they didn't take her word for it that this is a real fiancé.
Sure.
They investigated, and B, even if it was established that it was real, that didn't guarantee her reentry. That only got her in the game where they would further consider.
Yes.
And then C, it ultimately is a discretionary call by somebody.
And that is the most wild part to me.
Yeah.
That is the most wild part to me. This might surprise you. I don't know if you know my overall opinion on immigration. Here's the deal. If my family was down there, and, you know, Evelyn did bring up the point that, you know, the economy in Mexico was doing a lot better. So a lot more people wanting to stay there. It's doing better. I would still. United States is right there. It's right there. I would try to get my family by any means. And if I had to take advantage of a broken or really weird system, you're darn right I would. Mm-hmm. Right? And so instead of getting upset at the immigrants themselves, why don't we look at our own policy and actually get a system together and not call it an immigration system? Because as we learned today, it is a garbage system.
I think the answer to that is because there's lots of folks and they don't agree on what that system should be.
Sure. You know? Okay.
And by the way, the point about I'd want to come up here, most Mexicans don't. There's a lot of them that would love to come up here.
Work a little bit. Go home.
Send some money home. Sure. Go home. There used to be a huge seasonal.
Yeah. McCain was a big fan of that.
But what that takes is essentially a fluid border. You're going to come here. You're not going to go south unless you know that next year you can get north again.
Exactly. You know? No, that makes sense. I remember I was managing certain properties around town, certain apartment complexes and the like. And when SB 1070 hit, everybody went home to Mexico for Christmas. They didn't come back.
Yep.
They're like, we're hightailing out of here. And I think in a lot
of it's not hospitable.
Thank you. That's exactly the word I was using.
You see that in the hospitality industry. You see, there's tomato farmers in Alabama, Mississippi are just furious. They're seeing stuff die in the vein because there's nobody to pick it.
Right.
I mean, on and on and on. Little niches where, in point of fact, you're not able to get Americans to fill the jobs at any price.
Exactly. So now let me get your opinion on this because you study economics as well. So we hear that all the time. They're taking our jobs. They're coming here and taking our jobs, which are mostly, by the way, which are mostly labor positions. So they say they're coming and taking our jobs. When we're talking about the tomatoes, you're talking about the farmers, the farm work and things like that. You hear that argument quite often. I always thought, until I see a giant line at 4 a.m. in these fields of U.S. citizens, your argument's invalid.
Those jobs, the point is there may be some case somewhere. Or somebody, there's a
then
whole.
Then go get that job. Trust me, you're going to get hired.
There's a whole class of jobs where you are not getting Americans lined up for them.
Sure.
But I'm not going to deny the possibility that somewhere, somehow.
There's always
but
a somewhere, somehow.
We forget the net of that. The net of that is also we have export markets. And, if you used to work in a textile factory in South Carolina and it's no longer there, you blame immigration and you blame blame trade. By the way, real quickie, I got to tell you the biggest outrage in the whole immigration
system. Give me
the
outrage. Give it to me, Doc.
We have this whole anti-communist holdover, so Cubans get free passes for a while after Tiananmen. Chinese got free passes. There's people who get free passes, and there's people in, for example, Central America who are living in war zones who basically, the mom's told your kid joins the gang or you're dead, your whole family. And those we don't let those folks in.
Nope.
But we're still trying to make this anti-communist.
Hold on, your anger is taking time to your plug.
Any Cuban, plug. MichaelNeal.org. All the old shows, you'll find them all there. That's the big one. Michael J. O'Neill on Twitter. Yours?
At Mike Russell, KTAR. That's it, man. This was a very informative day. How about us? You're trying to get the bottom down. Get down to the bottom of the
immigration debate. I think we learned something
today,
Mike.
We did. We learned that we need a lot more Martha Mowers around us joining, I tell you that much. So they should go down and recruit. Anyone that has a resume like that, raise your hand. Yeah, we'll let you right in. Thanks for spending some time with us on The Think Tank, KTAR News.